And welcome back to the Roundtable. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. 12 minutes after 9 o'clock, time for this edition of our Roundtable panel. I am Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. Joining us today, Alan Shartok, and Times Union Associate Editor. Today he's the Associate Editor. Sometimes he's the Executive Editor. It depends on how the script is written. Mike Spain is with us. Hi, Mike. Hi, Alan. Nice to have you guys here.
How'd you do?
Before we get to the business at hand, let's get to some business at hand, and that is the fund drive, which is coming up, and the lockbox, and how the two tie together. No one better to talk about that than me, but in this case, we'll let Alan do it. Alan, the lockbox up to $119,000.
Yeah, almost $120,000.
What is the significance of that?
Significance is today, and I mean today, we got to get everybody marching over there and put another $100,000 in there to match last year's total.
Right.
Last time's total. I mean, up until now, I've been nice. I've been saying it nice way. Please do it.
Nice for you. Yeah, I mean, let's be clear.
Please do it. Would you please do it? But now I'm telling you, you know, it's your radio station. Hey. You know.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
go.
The thing is,
let's get to it.
If you want the programming back, best way to do is feed the kitty now, because on the first day, all the money in the lockbox counts. We shorten the fund drive.
Without question. And by the way, unlike almost everybody else, you know what we do? We go till we have the money we need.
Exactly.
Now, there are many people who say, we're going to raise, we're looking for $500,000 in 7 days. And then the 7 days come, they don't get anything like $500,000. They don't tell you anything. I mean, I don't know.
Are you going to name names here? I mean,
no.
I think Mike's, he's
no.
a journalist.
No, and, I'm not
going
to name
He's going to ask
names.
That inevitable question.
But I am going to say it's painful because I give money to those stations.
Right.
I do.
Okay.
And then I always wonder, how can you say you need the money, not get the money, and then keep going? I've never understood that part of it.
Well, your audience knows that you keep going till you get the money.
That's right. And the best way to that's Mike Spain. No. He's our guest. Be kind.
Oh yeah. Okay.
The best way to shorten the drive is feed the kitty now. Get into the lockbox. WAMC.org. Make a secure online pledge. It'll count on day one, which, by the way, is Monday morning. I'm telling you, Alan, we have to be here really early on Monday.
Like, I don't know that.
Okay, well, I just want to make sure you're there, because otherwise it'll be mighty quiet.
No, you'll be doing it.
Well, it'll be mighty quiet.
All right,
down to the business at hand on the roundtable. Some news stuff to talk about. And one I saw out of the Syracuse paper today, court allows 174th Attack Wing, that's the drone wing, to keep order of protection against drone protesters. I'll read you the first bit of this piece from the Syracuse paper. The New York State Supreme Court will stay out of the question of whether the DeWitt Town Court can issue a restraining order to protect a colonel in the 174th Attack Wing of the New York Air National Guard from drone protesters. And the protesters say, well, this order goes too far. It violates our First Amendment rights. Mike, have you had a chance to take a look at this?
Yeah, some background here is that the Syracuse area has a lot of very active anti-war protesters. They've been this way for decades. There's a very solid group, and they've been protesting drone attacks by going to the air base in Hancock in central New York. And this is going to step on their ability to protest. Now, the question is, why does a colonel need an order of protection? What is the risk? What is the danger that an army colonel has by people expressing their opinions?
Yeah.
There's no indication in this, and there's no indication in the history of these protesters that they do anything violent. You know, they might take symbolic action like burning draft cards in the old days, et cetera.
Yeah.
But is there really any bodily harm risk to the colonel and to the soldiers at the airbase because of this? That's really the question. And it would seem that there wasn't any case for real risk. So why would town justices go ahead and issue these protection orders?
What do you think, Alan?
Well, here's what I think. First of all, I could take the other side just for the heck of it.
All right.
But I won't, because, I think the First Amendment principle is very strong. But, we have seen this before. What you have to do is project yourself into some of these guys who start screaming at people who go into abortion areas. And judges have ordered them to stand back, too. So it's a question of where you're standing, I think, to some degree. I think it's a question of making sure. Mike, I have a fight with my lovely Roselle all the time. she leaves her keys in her car sometimes. Uh-oh, I think I've gone and done it now.
Oh, here we go.
Where is that car parked, and what make and model is it?
Yes, yes.
So, and then she says, it doesn't matter, Alan. It's never been stolen.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then I always say there's always a first time. Now, we do know that people like Andrew Cuomo, and you know, who has got his comeuppance from our wonderful district attorney, David Soares, would love to get clear them all out of there. Get them out of there, the Occupy people, and don't let them stand on a blade of grass or whatever. I'm, you know, going a little further than mm-hmm. actually, but there's always a business about people don't like to be taken whatever. They don't like to be pushed around. So governors don't like it, mayors don't like it. I don't like it every once in a while when it happens, but of course we put up with it because it's part of the deal. People may call me a lefty and go out in front of the place and
It's not part of the deal in the town of DeWitt. These protesters have had their they've been restricted from being able to express their opinion, which is contrary to the military's, position on the use of drones. And they're using this local military base to do it. I don't know. I think it's, you know, you bring in a good comparison to the Occupy situation in Albany.
Sure.
And that one was controversial. It remains controversial. It still is an issue in Albany Police Court, where the police court judge, Carter, would like to hold the district attorney's office in contempt for failing
to
prosecute
that.
Well,
isn't he an old boy from the old boy network?
Some would argue that. Yeah, that he's part of the old political machine.
Yeah, and didn't he run for something or something like that? Well, I don't remember the whole thing.
But in any event...
wasn't he a Klein's assistant district attorney?
There is a connection to the previous administration.
Right, so he's a little out of sorts maybe now that he's a judge. I don't know. Mm. You never know. Judges are human beings, you know.
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
But, of course, the larger question here is...
The larger question is whether cops are going to come put handcuffs on me for having just said that.
Well, if so, we're in Studio A, officer. Come in. The larger question is drones in general, and should, the protesters say we don't want them in our backyard. The question is, don't they have to be in somebody's backyard in order to do their job, or should they even be housed here?
I don't even know that. I think most of the drone... the handling of the drones are out in Utah or something like that. But because the Air Force has a presence in this region, and this is an area where there's a history of strong political protest, it's part of the culture of Syracuse,
mm-hmm.
that this happens there. It's their way of expressing it. It's like going to the IRS office or going to the federal building and burning your draft card, whatever. It's symbolic. This is all symbolic protest.
But what is interesting, Mike, don't you agree that... that we have a fairly liberal court system in New York State.
It is interesting that the Supreme Court will not touch it. As Supreme Court judges will kind of say, well, we'll just defer to the local. That's basically saying we don't want to get involved in this one. We don't want to elevate this to the level of a superior court. This is going on in town court. We'll just let it be.
Well, what would happen
is.
If we went to the Court of Appeals, which, is sort of left of center, but, which is our highest court for those
My
of
guess would be... That this protester group would find a favorable court. They
uh-huh.
would at least listen to them.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, well, that...
I'm
that
glad would... I brought some clarity to that.
Well played, gentlemen. Mike Spain is here from the Times Union. Alan Shartok is here. Dave Hopper, our engineer. We're going to take a break, and then we'll switch gears. It's 21 minutes after 9. You're listening to The Roundtable.
Support for WAMC comes from Clear Yoga in Rhinebeck. Iyengar Yoga for all ages and abilities, beginner, advanced, and special needs, working to build strength, focus, and peace of mind. ClearYogaRhinebeck.com. Catskill Hudson Bank, based in Kingston and specializing in commercial loans for local businesses and organizations, 12 branches in the Hudson Valley and Catskills. Member FDIC, equal housing lender, CatskillHudsonBank.com. And Albany Marriott, with 359 guest rooms, special event and meeting space with internet access, the Market Restaurant and Martini Lounge and airport transportation, Facebook, Twitter, or AlbanyMarriott.com.
Thank you. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Bumper music by the Police here, courtesy of Dave Hopper.
Ooh, isn't that interesting?
Yes.
Did he just do that on the spot?
No. They were before you started
ranting.
Ranting and inviting the police to come and to take you away.
I didn't invite them.
All right, Mike Spain is here.
My friend.
Mike Spain is here from the Times Union. Alan Shartok, once again in a mood. And the print here from the Times Union is very small. Alan has lent me his I left my reading glasses at home.
No, I'm not lending them to you. I'm giving them to you.
Well, I got to tell you that these glasses are a bit. The prescription is.
They're two.
Yeah, I might as well be wearing electron microscopes this morning because I could see molecules now. It's very interesting. But this article from Rick Carlin in the Times Union today talks about Saratoga making a preemptive push, if you will, or I guess they're saying, look, we're ready for the full-scale casino, so let's get it done.
Well, according to Rick's story, and we've been following this whole issue of gaming in New York and the plans by Governor Cuomo to raise revenue and to help upstate economies by passing a constitutional amendment to allow full casino gambling in designated areas across New York State, is a big issue. Well, 10 years ago, the Saratoga Raceway, as it was known, that's the harness track, not to be confused with the Thoroughbred Racetrack, which is right next to it in Saratoga Springs. It's a year-round harness track operation, obtained a license to become one of the first racinos, they call them, because they have video lottery terminals,
They emulate slot machines.
Right. But they're basically
not really.
Video slots.
Yeah.
Right. And they brought those in, and it brought in traffic and revenue and added to their coffers and helped them expand a little bit. When they did that 10 years ago, the interesting thing was they didn't have a lot of politicians around. They weren't really embraced by city officials and chamber of commerce types. It was kind of passive approval of it. They wanted to make sure they were getting their money, and they weren't really crazy about the idea. Now, 10 years later, you had state senator, you had the state assemblyman, you had the chamber of commerce, you had all kinds of public officials there yesterday at the Saratoga Racino as they announced a $30 million expansion plan. They're going to put in a hotel, they're going to put in an indoor pool and a banquet facility in addition to the casino that they have now, and they are really poised to become one of the new casinos that would be allowed if the state voters pass a constitutional amendment. The governor hopes that will be on the ballot this November.
Well, the governor has done deals now with two of the Indian nations.
That's right.
And a third probably happening with the Senecas out west.
Right. So it covers a lot of New York State.
Well, but not Saratoga.
Exclusivity. Basically, he brokered deals first with the Oneida Indians to give Turning Stone a exclusive status in that part of New York State and the surrounding counties. The Oneida Indians, in return, have pledged to pay a portion of their profits to the state, and they basically have resolved a lot of differences that have existed for a long time.
But the interesting thing here is that these are big areas. So now the areas where possibly, assuming that the amendment goes through, and I think Governor Cuomo probably wants to get this done sooner rather than later.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so it limits the spots where casinos could go upstate.
Right. Really, the Catskills, the Hudson Valley, and the Capital District, and then a swath of land that goes from Binghamton up through the Finger Lakes is really all that's left after these deals are approved. You know, and he's already brokered one with the Mohawks in the Akwesasne, casino up in the Adirondacks, and then he's working with the Senecas in Western New York. So if those little areas are left, and part of this plan by the governor is, and this would be part of the bill, that the New York City area cannot get casinos until, I think, 5 years or a few years after these
He's fighting with Shelley Silver about
right.
that, apparently.
And it's another issue of contention. Now there's a Republican plan, an alternative plan by Senator John Bonachek, and he's saying, and he's getting some traction with Republicans, that they would be in the Catskills and they would be in the Hudson Valley. So while that all gets meted out, it looks like Saratoga Springs is going to be a likely location.
It's an even money bet at this point.
It's a big money bet, and people are banking on that, and it looks like that the raceway would have a head start.
Well, I have something to say about this. I thought that, as usual, I thought that Andrew Cuomo wanted to make a statement about upstate New York. He's always looking for ways to say upstate New York, because that's where the votes are that he doesn't traditionally, you know, get. Or that he might, well, not the first time, but he might not get it. Okay, so he's always looking for those upstate votes. And so, you know, I don't know that Saratoga is it was his target issue. I think the Catskills certainly were something that he was looking at, which really have been in the doldrums. But Ray, you know, you know some people who go to gambling casinos, don't you?
What's your point?
Well, where are they more likely to go, Saratoga or?
I think you're more likely to go what's near you.
What's near you. And I then, mean, of course, I don't want to leave out our Massachusetts wonderful listeners. I consider that home because that's where I live.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's a whole thing in Springfield now that everybody's competing for the existing licenses over there. They're making all kinds of moves in order to make themselves more attractive. Will it help a city? Did it help Atlantic City? Hell no. Will it help Springfield? We don't know. But, boy, people are really fighting for it. And when you do that, you really philosophically have to scratch your head and say, are we doing people a favor here who really need the money?
Well, it's a larger question. But, I mean, in the case of the casinos in Connecticut, and if you look at the Oneida deal, I think 25% of their take will now go to the state.
Yeah.
So I think Mike might correct me if I'm wrong with that.
It's revenues. I mean, it is a source of revenue, and the governor is looking for revenue. He has also pledged to help the upstate economies.
But I think he's hurting. I'm sorry, Mike. I think he may be hurting people who shouldn't be spending their money.
I think you're bringing up an alternate point of view, which I think is completely legitimate in this. Yeah. And I think if this is on the ballot in November, that will be a big part of the argument that gambling, has it really helped Atlantic City? Does it really help these communities?
But has it helped, putting aside Atlantic City and putting aside the town, New London and down in Connecticut, has it helped the state? And Foxwoods and Mohegan Sun pump, I don't know how many tens of millions of dollars a year into
Raymond,
the state conference.
At what cost?
On whose back is that?
It's on the back of a lot of people from New York who may not go there if all of a sudden Saratoga is open for business.
You sound awfully passionate about this.
No, but there is a great argument here. Unfortunately, gentlemen, we're just about out of time in this segment. So I'll give myself the last word. Mike Spain is here. He's the associate editor of the Times Union. Alan Chartok, the grand poobah and the wearer of ridiculously strong reading glasses, which I may not wear for the entire segment, is here. We'll be back with more on the Roundtable coming up. Welcome back to the Roundtable. 9:37 is the time. Ray Graff here, in for Joe Donahue. Alan Chartok also here, and Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain. And I've been reminded ad nauseum by Alan that you can join in the conversation by emailing us, roundtable@wamc.org. Pop us an email. And in fact, please pop us an email, because Alan has been on my case for not mentioning the email address. I'll say it one more time, roundtable@wamc.org.
Cool.
You happy now?
I'll never be happy, but I'm happier.
Okay, on to the next topic, and Mike pointed this one out. This is from the Washington Post by Walter Pincus, and the first line says it all. When will journalists take responsibility for what they do without circling the wagons and shouting that the First Amendment is under attack? Now, he is speaking of the Fox News correspondent James Rosen. In this case,
he writes a very interesting column in which he points out that we really don't know much, and that journalists are human beings, too, and that they have to be held responsible for the laws of the United States the same way that other human beings do. And the journalists, of course, come back and say, you can never tell anybody in the press that, you know, that they have to limit what they're doing.
And Pincus actually says, well, now hold the phone. Now, he gives us some background here. June 11, 2009. Rosen published a scoop on Fox News' website that disclosed how North Korean officials plan to hold another nuclear test in response to a UN security resolution condemning Pyongyang for recent tests. So, suddenly, the Pentagon said, well, how the heck did you get this out there and why?
Well, he's an interesting guy to be taking this point of view for a whole lot of reasons. When he was in the Army, he worked in intelligence. And even during his journalism career, he took time out to work for Senate investigation committees and to be involved in intelligence matters. He's also an attorney with a degree from Georgetown Law School.
Mm-hmm.
So he brings a lot of different perspectives. And he was personally involved in the Valerie Flame CIA leak case back during the Bush administration. So it is kind of interesting to hear his point of view. He points out that a journalist who hears or receives confidential intelligence information from a source is actually then a co-conspirator in that transaction and can be charged under the law. And he's suggesting that the media shouldn't be rounding the wagons and just defending their First Amendment rights, but they should be also looking at the damage that certain national security leaks can cause. And in this case, he says, by reporting this story, Fox News revealed that the U.S. government had sources inside North Korea and had access to inside information in the North Korean government. And that would probably shut that source down. And people would, you know, people in South Korea, people in Japan, people all over the world who could be victimized by a nuclear launch by this wacky North Korean government, this is serious stuff, and maybe they shouldn't have reported all that, and they should have been more discreet. And, you know, that's his point of view.
Now, countering that, of course, we have the Bay of Pigs, where even Kennedy said he had wished the Times had, you know, or somebody said that they wished that the Times had done the story because it would have protected him and protected the country from a really bad idea. Then you get the Pentagon Papers, same deal. Then, of course, you get WikiLeaks and everything there. But WikiLeaks, I think, as you just pointed out, Mike, becomes much more problematic because there we are talking about, spies in place.
Right. Well, no, I think we're talking about spies in place here as well.
Yeah, we are.
Right. And,
no,
and is
that's
it,
right.
Do journalists have a total immunity from any repercussions if they report these details of confidential informants inside foreign governments, and they reveal the names of spies who are still out there and put them at risk? You know, are they immune from any repercussions? I guess that's a rhetorical question.
I thought WikiLeaks was great, but I really stepped back on this issue of, you know, our assets.
Well, my question for you, Mike, and I'm sure you don't have an exact number, but I mean, is this common that reporters in Washington or elsewhere will get access to classified information?
Well, I think that my sense is that these guys like Walter Pincus, who cover national security issues for major news media, probably know an awful lot more than they print. And they probably exercise some level of judgment. It may be because they're afraid of being prosecuted as co-conspirators, like he suggests, or it may be that they just judge that certain information is not useful, that the value of getting the story out does not outweigh the risk to individuals who are doing this, doing the spying or leaking this information to us, the U.S. government, I mean. And, you know, so I'll bet you that a whole lot more is known in the inner circles than is printed in and published and put on the on the web and on the air.
So the White House Correspondents Association, predictably, at least a tepid defense of Rosen. And it said, and this again, quoting from the Pincus article, reporters should never be threatened with prosecution for the simple act of doing their jobs, but admitted, this is the White House Correspondents Association board.
I love this.
They admitted, we don't know all the facts in these cases, but our country was founded on the principle of freedom of the press, and nothing is more sacred to the profession. So,
well, did you read the next
line?
I mean, Walter Pincus says, I worry that many other journalists think that the last phrase should be, nothing is more sacred than our profession. And you know, that's a warning that journalists shouldn't feel so high and mighty and be above the law, that they're also citizens and they have responsibilities like everybody else, which I think is true. I don't think that journalists should get any extra privilege. They should have the same access that the public has, but, you know, they are designated to get information and pass it on to everybody else. But generally, we, the media, are citizens, and you know, we have the same rights that any citizen has, and every citizen has First Amendment rights, even those protesters in Syracuse. But that's another story.
That's the first half of the show. Now, you mentioned you uttered the word co-conspirator earlier, and that's not. That was not a sort of random choice of words.
Oh, no,
this is what they're using as a defense, or not a defense, but as a pretext for the warrant, yes?
Yes, that's correct. Pincus points out, and like I said, he's an attorney and he's versed on these things, that reporters can be labeled as co-conspirators, aiders and abettors, and accessories in criminal leak cases.
But they almost never are. In other words, right. They can be. So it's what we call the law of anticipated reaction.
Well, in a few cases, though, I mean, you know,
people have gone to jail for not disclosing.
Right. So if a government insider leaks information to you, national security information, sensitive information,
sure.
And you publish it, you print it, you post it online, whatever, and a prosecutor comes to you and says, where'd you get that information? Because it was a crime for that person to give that information
right.
to you. You know the name of the guy that committed the crime. You're required to tell me who that is so I can prosecute
That's them. Right. But that's not co-conspirator. That's, you know, you're flouting the law, telling you that you have to tell, as opposed to being a conspirator in the act.
Well, I kind of agree with you, but that would be my defense. But a judge and jury might find it otherwise if you have an aggressive prosecutor.
Which is one of the reasons why, if the people, and according to Pew and everybody else, we know that people don't like the press, which is one of the reasons that you don't want to go before a jury.
Right. Media lawyers really understand that, you know, that juries can be made very sympathetic to the other side. And
to their government and security, which is in many people's minds, I don't like it, but it right. becomes number one, their number one priority. Okay, you want a Mussolini in, he'll protect you. So that's it.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Associate Editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain, is here. Alan Shartok is here, and we're talking about the issue of Fox News correspondent James Rosen. And an article, a commentary piece, I guess, written by Walter Pincus in the Washington Post, taking Rosen to task to some extent and laying out the facts of this case. You know, if somebody who has access to this information, a high-level guy, Drew Pearson or whatever, you know, and they're labeled a co-conspirator, does this have a similar chilling effect that the whole AP scandal had in guys who are trying to do the job? In other words, James Rosen... he's unlikely to get any information again. I think he can probably go, you know, do the Page Six now because he is not going to get that information. So if you're labeled a co-conspirator, does that make everybody step back and say, oh, geez.
You know? No. I think, and Mike knows more about this than I do, but and everything else also, but isn't it true that if somebody will use what you hand them, that they're more likely, other people are more likely to go to those people?
That's because, right. Because people get identified as being, you know.
No, I don't want to give it to Shartok. He's not going to use it, but
right,
I'll give it to some other guy.
Somebody else uses it. Yeah. And I kind of disagree, Ray. Rosen may now have a badge of courage.
Sure.
He may be somebody you can drop a dime on or drop drop in the mail a confidential report, and you'll know that he'll publish it now because he's already demonstrated he has no hesitancy to publish very sensitive information about Korea, for example.
But the real stuff, the important stuff, can he be trusted now by those in the power
elite?
Well,
the only reason we know that, you know, according to the stories that have come out over the weekend in this column by Walter Pincus yesterday in the Washington Post, I mean, what we know is that the government was tracking him and the government employee or the contractor who was passing the information to him, and they have all these, you know, swipe cards and phone calls, and you know, the employee or the contractor called up this report on his screen at the same time he was talking to Rosen on the phone. I mean, it's government surveillance. It wasn't Rosen revealing the source or doing anything that maybe he should have been more careful.
Walter yes. Pincus is not related to Marcus Pincus by any chance, is he?
Or Ian Pincus, for that matter.
Ian Pincus.
Oh, that's it's Ian Pincus.
Close enough.
Oh, our news director is. I got to write that down.
Marcus Pincus is the end of a wonderful joke, but I really can't tell it here.
you know, you're already in fun drive mode, telling punchlines to jokes that you can't tell. Hey, this is a great spot to take a break. Mike Spain is here. Alan Chartok is here. I'm Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. You're listening to The Roundtable. If you'd like to weigh in, it's roundtable@wamc.org. Hopper, take it.
Support for WAMC comes from SPAC, presenting New York City Ballet, featuring the Ballet Gala, the Ruby Ball, July 13th, with SPAC Junior Committee hosting the Lawn Party, fireworks, after-party dancing, and more. This year, GE sponsors kids and Citizens Bank sponsors students. SPAC.org for tickets. Godfrey Financial Associates, Latham, New York, providing retirement planning and wealth management services for baby boomers and beyond. Independent, woman-owned, established 1995. GodfreyFinancial.com. And Handmade and More, New Paltz, specializing in spring, summer, women's casual professional, and weekend fashion from American-made designers such as Click, Comfy, and Eucalyptus, 845-255-6277, and on Facebook.
I love these bumpers because Alan is here singing along with the Police. It's great. It's nice to. This was post Weavers, but it's good stuff, right?
True.
And you enjoy the sting and everybody
I
else.
I enjoy the noise.
Noise?
Noise.
Interesting. Sound like an old timer there. Yeah, 10 minutes before 10 o'clock, we're in the home stretch of the round
table. And you look like Bill Gannon.
Thank you very much. And again, save that for the fun drive, which is coming up on Monday. If you want to make your pledge online and feed the lockbox, please do so. It'll shorten the fun drive.
And by the way, Pat gave me some very bad news yesterday. Pat Cooney.
Okay.
That they're going to paint the antenna, the tower.
Which tower is this?
The big one up on
Greylock.
Yeah, Greylock, and it's sometime. They wanted to do it during the fun drive. We said, no, we wouldn't want that to happen. So apparently it's going to happen the next couple of days.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
In this weather?
Well, that's a good point you make.
Now, usually when I fill in on the round table, we're on reduced power anyway. So
why is that?
I don't know. It just seems to happen that way.
Oh, I see.
Towers will fall down or there'll be a nice storm. All right. So the last topic I wanted to talk about today was, and it's been all over the news, it's been all over NPR. Moms are now the primary breadwinners in 40% of homes. In 1960, that was just 11%. And this is all from a Pew Research Center.
Pew.
And so what does this tell you guys? You're old-timers.
Well, it tells us that somehow the glass ceiling is being lifted. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I agree. I think it demonstrates that there's less inequality in the workplace for women, mm-hmm. and that at the same time, the tradition of the man going to work and being the breadwinner and mom staying at home and raising all the kids is a model that is diminishing.
Yeah.
It's still a good model. It exists, but it's not prevalent like it was in the 50s and 60s.
Well, you know, I'm a child of a working mother who was, by the way, the major salary in the family.
Yeah.
My father made some money. I mean, did his job and came home from work. But my mother made the money, whatever it was. And, you know, so I've always felt that there is no other way. I've never even considered the idea that, you know. But there are a lot of people who still believe, as Mike says, that this is the right thing to do, to stay home, raise the children, inculcate them with the right values, take care of them, and the rest.
But these surveys are showing that more and more situations, the fathers are staying home, and the mothers are going to work also. I mean, that's part of this.
Well, we read it every once in a while about this, but is it really prevalent? I mean, that the fathers stay home
more so now, and I can't.
Well, I know you guys keep fudging it by saying more.
Well, I have the numbers here, but I have to hold the paper at arm's length because
put those glasses on. I gave you.
Well, I can't use those either. That it's too close. But you know, in my neighborhood and in my town, most moms work. Both parents work.
Of course.
And yet the surveys show that not everybody is completely happy with that. They appreciate the opportunity to do it, and they defend the right and the opportunity to do it. But when people are surveyed, according to this survey, they do say, you know, there is value to having a parent.
Absolutely.
Home. Yeah. You know, it's
and both of you guys had a lot of children, right? I mean,
And my wife stays home.
Yeah.
And I know several moms, friends of hers who do that. But I mean, one thing that always has to be paramount in this discussion is that I don't think there's a harder job than being a mom.
No, there isn't.
And those who do both are just astounding. They astound me. Mm, so yeah. much strength.
But there's also something called economics at work here.
Absolutely.
Which is that, you know, in the old days, that's the way it was. You know, the father went, came back, and the mother took care of the house. That doesn't happen anymore because I don't think our economic needs, our paradigm is, I think the paradigm has shifted, as the political scientists say, and that's it.
If both parents work, they can provide more for their children. They can provide more educational opportunities and more, you know, a more stable lifestyle. They can also afford to hire daycare, you know.
Well, that's a huge part of the child care.
We did.
Part of that equation. I mean, it's so expensive. And
or a home sitter, you know.
We spent one salary. We both worked all the time, but we spent one salary basically after taxes.
So that begs the question, why do that?
Because people have intellect, people have, you know.
Are you saying being a mother is not intellectually stimulating?
No, Mike, I have to answer this. I have to answer this very serious charge. I'm not saying that at all.
Okay, because that's what it sounded like.
No, I know what you tried to make out of it.
Okay.
But what I think...
roundtable@wamc.org, moms.
But what I think is that people have a right to choose. Women have a right to choose. Do I go to work or do I stay home with the kids? That's what I'm talking about, Ray. And I take some exception to the dastardly thing you did there.
Well, all I can say is it's not black and white. There are a lot of parents that stretch. Lots of friends of mine and a lot of people who I work with stretch it, where the father will work early, the mother will work late, and there'll be a short period in between, maybe during school where the kids are in school. I mean, getting to that point, it's a shared responsibility. When I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, the father went to work and the mother did all the child rearing. Today, I think a lot of fathers take a big responsibility in child rearing. They change diapers, they take care of kids,
yes,
they cook, they pack lunches, they do all the things that in the past only the mother would do. And I think it's a good thing. I think it's a shared responsibility, and that's probably the
Sounds like a good vox pop, doesn't it?
It would be an interesting vox pop.
Yeah.
Alas, today's Pets and Vets, so we won't be doing that today on Vox Pop.
Again, Pets and
Vets? You're scowling again.
You people, you know what you do to me.
What?
Well, you promised me we're not going to have Pets and Vets except once a month.
Right.
And then every time I walk in here on a Wednesday, I say, what's today? They say, Pets and Vets.
But you only ask once a month.
No, I ask every day, and it's always Pets and Vets.
It's an enormously popular topic.
Thank you, Mike Spain of the Times Union.
It's about the dogs that, you know, eat stuff.
Okay. Well, we have a few minutes left, so let's keep going on this. About 51% of survey respondents say the children are better off if a mother is home and doesn't hold a job. So it seems traditional thinking still has a slim majority.
But look at the 29%. I think it's 29% in there somewhere, which basically says that that they don't know that it's right. They approve of it, but they don't know that it's right. Do you understand what I'm saying?
That mother's... Yeah. Go to work or mothers?
That mothers do go to work,
right.
Yeah. So in other words,
right.
A
there's
lot of
some,
people, yeah.
Right, ambivalence about it.
Dissonance.
There's absolutely enormous economic benefits to the mother going.
Well, I don't think it's, I mean, I have to think that it's almost not doable these days. But
to stay at home.
Yeah.
It's a struggle, but it's a value decision too. Some people make it based on values. Some it's practical.
Some people work from home.
That's right. And,
true
you know,
enough.
That's another factor. You know, a lot of people can work at home and pace it around. They can work late at night because of the access of computers give them and the kind of work they do. So I think there's more mixed models like that. And it's hard to just, you know, you use the 1950s model and say it's been turned upside down. It's just very different today.
Yeah.
And I knew my 1950s model.
Oh, you did? And what was her name?
I forget. Okay. But...
But we probably ought to talk more about this.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, the census says that only about 3.5% of the stay-home parent households are men. But I think that's growing. I think that...
I knew it. I knew you guys were gilding the lily before.
Yes.
Why do you say that?
Because you said more and more people are doing it, and it turns out it's only 3.5%.
3.5%
of finally, households. So finally, Mike fesses up and you fess up.
Well, I think the big part of this is child care and where that goes. And as more and more...
options.
Families are either single parent workers or dual income. childcare is the huge discussion down the road, and
the quality of childcare
and how much
affordability of
childcare
becomes.
But not all mothers are really great child caregivers either. Most are, but there are some who aren't.
Now, what do you mean?
I mean, the psychiatrist's couches are filled with people who are telling stories about what their mothers said to them or did to them.
Right. Well, I know that cliche.
All right. Fair enough. Well, listen, I tell you what, Hopper, let's get some police music up here and we'll wrap this up. Now, if you want to join the discussion, please do so. You can go to our website. It's WAMC.org. You can go to the roundtable page and comment there. You can also send us an email at roundtable@WAMC.org. You can hit us on Twitter. You can like us on Facebook. But anything you do, try to remember that our fun drive starts on Monday morning, and we are trying to shorten the drive now. We have the lockbox going. Make a pledge now. Shorten the drive. Hey, it's not out of the question that we can raise $1 million and get to the point where there's no fun drive. Just put all the money in now. You don't like that idea, do you?
Oh, I love it, but I think a lot of people would be disappointed. They love the fun drive.
I would like to see $1 million
and
in the lockbox.
And I don't want to see somebody talking to me on the street, however, and saying to me, you know, I don't like the fun drive. I say, did you give?
Okay. Mike Spain, thanks a lot for being here, my friend. I appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
Alan Chartok, thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable.